It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. More than 5 million children have been born through in vitro fertilization, or IVF, over the past 37 years. After the birth of a child or children through IVF, many families have extra frozen embryos that must either be stored, disposed of, or donated for scientific research. There is another option, and that's called embryo transfer. Some people call that adoption. Lydia Fine of Iowa City and her husband have two beautiful children conceived through in vitro fertilization, and when it came time to decide what to do with their remaining embryos, they chose transfer. Lydia is here with me now. Hello, Lydia.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me a little bit about your journey to in vitro fertilization. What made you decide that was the right option for you?
Sure. Well, we really didn't have many other options. And we were really lucky to be very close to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, which has an amazing in vitro program. So we got married in 2009 and started trying to have a baby shortly after, and realized pretty quickly that I had plenty of eggs in there, but they just didn't feel like coming out. So we tried lots of different things, just using oral medication, and unfortunately, nothing really worked. We tried injectable medications, and my body responded a little too well, and they were concerned that we could end up in a possible scary octomom sort of situation. And because I have great insurance coverage, which I know I'm very lucky to have, the team at the U recommended that we move to in vitro fertilization. So we went on to that option in fall of 2011. And did our first, what they call egg retrieval process. So it took hormones to make lots of eggs mature at once. And they did the retrieval and did our first transfer in September of 2011, which failed, unfortunately. But a few months later, we did another transfer of a frozen embryo, which resulted in our daughter, who will be three very shortly. And then again in 2013, we did another transfer of a frozen embryo, which resulted in our son, who just turned one.
And you really didn't want to have multiple children at the same time. So you were transferring one embryo each time.
Yes. It's called elective single embryo transfer. And my husband and I were very, very dedicated and committed to elective single embryo transfer. There are a lot of wonderful things about twins, but there are also a lot of risks. And we wanted one healthy baby at a time.
So after your son's birth, you had embryos still in storage. How did you decide that you were done?
Well, my husband is significantly older than me. Okay, not that much. Maybe he's 11 years older than me, so he's 45. And he never really wanted kids, and I managed to talk him into one. And then I managed to pull a bait and switch and talk him into two. So, you know, he travels a lot for his work, and two was about the most I could handle. And our family really felt complete. And, you know, people say that their families didn't feel complete and they could just feel it. Well, we can just feel it. Like, immediately after my son was born, I'm like, this is all I ever wanted. This is great. So I knew we had three embryos remaining in storage, and we had talked before we ever did IVF about what we might do, and we had talked about donating for research. But after having these amazing little beautiful creatures in our lives, we realized that we couldn't pass up the opportunity to give such an amazing gift to a family who could not have children on their own.
I can imagine that for a lot of people that would be a very difficult decision, because these are genetically your children, and mm-hmm. if they are carried by another woman, they will be her biological children, but they will be genetic siblings mm-hmm. of your children. Mm-hmm. How did you think that through?
Gosh, well, you know, I think it's difficult, and there were moments where I thought, I don't know if I can do this. But when it came right down to it, I thought, how will I feel down the road if I discard these embryos or I donate them for research and I have to live with the fact that I could have changed someone's life forever for the better by providing them with a child? And I didn't do it because it made me feel uncomfortable, or I didn't do it because it was hard. Like, there's a lot in life that we do anyway, even though it's hard, because it's the right thing. And my husband and I felt very, very strongly that this was the right thing to do for humanity, for our fellow man. We didn't even know our recipients at this point, but we knew this was what we wanted.
Now, a lot of people never do know their recipients. You can elect to allow someone to use your embryos and never know how that goes. But that wasn't the route you wanted to take. Why is that?
Right. So when you donate anonymously, most of the time you never find out if a pregnancy or a live birth resulted from your embryos. And for me, that uncertainty was just too much. I pictured myself walking through the grocery store in Des Moines and seeing a little girl or a little boy who looked like one of my children and you know, accosting that mother to find out if she donated, if she adopted rather embryos. And I'm just not the kind of person who deals well with that sort of ambiguity. So we decided we wanted to go the known adoption route, which was infinitely more complicated and more time consuming, but it was what felt right for us.
Well, now seems like the perfect moment to bring Lauren Jarrell into the conversation. She and her husband live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she hopes to become a mother thanks to this gift from Lydia and her husband. Hello, Lauren.
Hi. I'm getting emotional. This is hearing this story, no matter how many times I hear Lydia talk about it. I get emotional because it's such a beautiful gift that she's giving us.
Well,
we're thankful.
Lauren, tell us a little bit about your story. You have tried to become a mother and nothing has worked out for you. What are some of the options that you've explored?
My husband and I have been married since 2011 and started trying to have a family shortly thereafter. We were diagnosed within the year of trying with male factor infertility. So our diagnosis is on the male end of things. The good news is that I check out just fine. To carry a pregnancy, I should be fine. We tried several IUIs, several rounds of it.
And what is an IUI?
Oh, I'm sorry. An intrauterine insemination. So it's taking, my husband's sperm, kind of putting it through this spinny washing thing and taking the best sperm and injecting it into my uterus during a timed cycle, during the cycle where I'm ovulating. And so they were never successful. They didn't work. And then we kind of took a break for a while. We bought a house. We kind of focused on ourselves and trying to be the better versions of ourselves so that when the time came that we were ready to become parents, well, we were ready, but by the time we were going to become parents that we were ready and successful and happy. So we took a break and I started researching some other options. We could have done IVF with our own egg and sperm. We just didn't feel confident in that, and the expense of it was just way more than we could imagine, and it just wasn't something we could afford. Therefore, I started researching. I like to say I've got a doctorate from Google University, that I learned lots and lots of options, and what's so beautiful is that there's so many opportunities out there and options for couples that are infertile to start their families, and I came across a website about embryo adoption or embryo donation, and I woke up one morning and told my husband about it. He was a little bit on the fence about it, but we kind of went into it and researched it, and long story short, we were introduced to Lydia and Nathan, this amazing couple in Iowa, and things happened rapidly. We were introduced to them, and within 3 to 4 days of meeting them and them learning about us, they offered us their embryos. And
so how did you find each other?
We found each other through a small agency that's based out in Washington. It's called Blessed with Infertility. It's ran by a woman who herself has adopted embryos, and she just kind of felt this compelled to help other couples in similar situations. And so we applied with that agency, paid a fee, and she meshed us with Lydia and Nathan.
Well, and Lydia, tell me about first meeting Lauren and her husband.
Sure. So the matchmaker, so to speak, with this agency, Blessed with Infertility, works with only a small number of clients at any given time. And when we said we were ready to start looking at profiles of potential recipient parents, she sent me her first 4 profiles. And I opened the first one, and they're much like letters that you would see from people who want to be regular adoptive parents. Right. And I immediately was overwhelmed. The photographs, the long kind of imploring letters, I immediately was overwhelmed, and I closed the email and I didn't touch it for a couple of days. I told my husband, I don't think I can do this. And he said, no, you know, go back and read back through them, which I did. And none of them really jumped out at me. And I realized later I was really looking for people who reminded us of us. And I said to Samantha, the matchmaker, I said, none of these really, feel right. So, I don't know what to do next. And she said, I have a new client that I think you're going to love. I just have a feeling. And let me get her materials together and I'll send them to you. And that night I was laying in bed, just about to go to sleep, and my phone pinged, and it was about 10:30. And I got this letter, and it was Lauren and Jesse's initial kind of letter to us explaining who they are and what they're all about. And as I read it, I got so excited. I almost woke up my husband so he could read it too. And it just was right on so many levels, and it felt amazing. It was like, these people are just like us, and they're wonderful and amazing. And this is who I would want to carry our genetic child as her own biological child. If I could choose anyone, I would want these people.
And Lauren, when mm-hmm. you first heard back from Lydia, tell me about your reaction.
Well, I think, as I said before, it happened so fast. And so my husband and I originally were just kind of researching this option. And so I was ready to go, like, the minute they sent some information back to us about them, I'm like, well, this is meant to be. This is the way it's supposed to be. My husband's a little bit more thoughtful. Thoughtful, and he wants to take time to think about things. But I somehow convinced him that I'm like, babe, this is what we're supposed to do. This is the family that is supposed to help us become parents. And it didn't take a lot of convincing. He too fell in love with Lydia and Nathan as well. And it was, just meant to be. And they're amazing. They're funny. They're Midwesterners like us. They're down to earth. They just have the same great personalities and great things about them that we feel we do as well. So.
Well, and Lydia, it sounds like when you first entered into this, you expected to kind of know who the parents were going to be and move on from there. But this has become a real friendship.
Yeah, I think a lot of these situations like this, you have to say, we want this amount of contact every year. And you have to spell out very clearly what you want your relationship to be like. And I'm very lucky that Lauren and I have become friends. And that's what part of why we were drawn to them. We joke that we married the same man, except in different states. Our husbands are so similar. It's hilarious. And Lauren and I are both bloggers. We love to write. We're both very similar. The connection's definitely there, and I'm really happy to say that we've become friends.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Lydia Fine of Iowa City and Lauren Jarrell of St. Paul, Minnesota, and we're talking this hour about embryo donation or adoption, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about embryo donation or embryo transfer. When people go through the process of in vitro fertilization, after successful pregnancies, there are often embryos that are left over, and families have to decide what to do with those. We'll talk about the other options in a few minutes as well. But right now, I'm talking with Lydia Fine of Iowa City. She and her husband have two children conceived through IVF, and they have decided to donate their remaining embryos to Lauren Jarrell and her husband, or Jarrell, who lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. And Lauren, before the break, we were talking about the connection that you and Lydia made, and in your husband's as well, when you started talking to each other. What is the plan from here, now that you've decided that you will be the recipients of the three embryos that Lydia and her husband have remaining? What happens next?
Yeah, so we're finalizing all of our legal stuff. So we do have to have a legal contract. So we have a lawyer. Lydia and Nathan have a lawyer. It's our responsibility to financially pay for both legal representation as the recipients. I think it's good to say that Lydia and Nathan are not here to gain any money from this, nor are they expected to pay for anything. They're donating their embryos to us. We are financially responsible for everything. And so now we are finishing up our legal contract. We have started working with the University of Iowa. We've decided not to move the embryos from where they were created, and they were created at the University of Iowa. So we'll be taking a fun little road trip down to Iowa. We've already taken one where we've kind of done some initial appointments to get ourselves established as patients at the University of Iowa. And then we're hoping to do an embryo transfer. And we, too, are very devoted to just transferring one embryo, not looking to transfer all three of them or even two of them. We want one good quality embryo transferred, and we hope to do that sometime this fall, late fall, mid fall. The timing is we're still trying to decide when that will all take place, but we're ready for it to happen and excited.
And Lydia, from your perspective, I mean, your first embryo transfer did not succeed when you were trying to conceive. How does it feel? This is not your body. This is not your child. But how does it feel looking at this process from the outside? And I know you have very high hopes for Lauren and Jesse.
I do. I think it will be nearly impossible, even though Lauren tells me regularly that I'm not allowed to feel guilty if it doesn't work. It will be impossible for me not to feel a little bit responsible because these are our genetic material. And if they don't get the job done, I'm going to be a little disappointed in them. And I'll be sad for Lauren because, as I said, we've grown to be friends. And if she's sad, I will be sad. So I have really high hopes and I'm going to do everything I can to cheer these little embryos on to becoming babies for them.
And now, of course, we've talked about this before. They are your genetic offspring. They will be Lauren's biological offspring mm-hmm. because she is the woman who will carry them, give birth to them, nurse them, and all of that. Mm-hmm. What kind of a relationship, if this works, do you hope that your kids will have with their genetic siblings mm-hmm. who are the children of Lauren and Jesse?
We're going to be very open with it, open about it with our children, because I'm already really open with them about their roots and being created through in vitro. People will say, oh, your son is so cute. And I'll say, oh, I think it was the Petri dish. He was artificially created in a laboratory. So it's part of their story already. So having a genetic sibling in Minnesota will be part of their story too. And I kind of picture this fantasy someday where our kids will be sitting down at 21 years of age in a bar somewhere over a beer and comparing stories like, oh, wow, you like cottage cheese with maple syrup? Me too. I think that would be awesome.
Well, Lydia and Lauren, thank you so much for being so open with your stories today. And I hope you keep us posted as things go on. And I stay with us through the hour. But I want to bring a few other people into this conversation now. Jeanette Clausen is lead caseworker of Pregnancy Counseling and Adoption Services, Lutheran Family Services. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And now, you deal with a lot of adoptions. This is not your typical adoption. Is this becoming more common?
It sure is. We're doing a lot to try to promote exactly what these two gals are talking about. And it's just a very viable way of adopting, a fresh way.
And what makes it a viable way for people? I mean, this is a pretty complicated process. How much goes into that process for an individual who's pursuing this?
Well, when somebody wants to do embryo adoption, we treat it like adoption in every way that we do a traditional adoption. So there's a lot of work involved, and I know Lauren had kind of referred to some of that, as did Lydia. But we do a full home study according to Iowa law on what an adoption home study needs to be. The reason we want to do that full home study is because we want to follow every channel to that, you know, so that it feels like adoption to both families, and so that both families have the assurance of the quality of family involved there.
Now, there are a few different routes to embryo donation, and Lydia and Lauren were talking about one of those routes. You're talking about a slightly different route to embryo donation. So do people who want to donate embryos, do they come to you and say, you know, please match us with a family, or how does that work?
LFS doesn't do the matching piece ourselves. What we do is we interface with an agency just like the one Lauren described out in Washington. It is called Snowflakes. It's a program through Nightlight Christian Adoptions. And we have them do the matching piece. They do all the paperwork storage, you know, the long-term type of thing. And then we do the preparation for the adoption through the home study, through the education piece. And if we get a donor, then we refer them to Snowflakes.
All right. And Snowflakes is an organization that like their adoptions to be open or known, kind of like the adoption we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. So there are many families out there, I would guess, or at least several families out there in the similar situation where there are genetic siblings who are being raised by different families. From your perspective, from what you've seen, how should families or how can families deal with that very special, specific situation?
Our recommendation is that they think of this in a child-centered way. Once we boil things down to, you know, we know how much the adults have to go through, but when you got this precious little baby or embryo, and you just really reduce it to what is best for this child, it becomes a little bit easier. We believe that children need to know their genetic roots. We believe that they need to know of their genetic siblings. And we want to do anything we can to encourage a healthy relationship between them. It doesn't mean it'll be like a normal sibling relationship, but absolutely it is healthy for them to understand everybody in the whole situation and how they got here.
All right. Well, this we're talking right now about the adoption part of this process. Of course, this process begins a long time before we get to this point. And Dr. Ginny Ryan is here. She's an assistant professor of reproductive endocrinology and infertility at the University of Iowa Carver School of Medicine. She practices at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Hello, Dr. Ryan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And so, all right, let's go back to the very beginning. When a couple has tried to conceive in other ways and gets to the point where in vitro fertilization seems like the best avenue for them, even at the beginning of that process, the idea that there will be leftover embryos is something that you talk to with patients, right?
Exactly. Yeah. At our very first visit with all of our patients, it's part of our written and verbal information summary that we present to patients to let them know that, especially younger women under 35, they have a greater than, I mean, about 60% of our women under 35 will have extra frozen embryos, and many women older as well. And so we really want people to start to anticipate what that might mean, both personally, socially, and legally. We talk already at that point about what our policies are for what we will do with those embryos. We have age limits on how long we'll store them, et cetera, things that we developed with our hospital legal and policy makers. And so we talk about that right from the get-go and try to have people anticipate those issues to some extent. And also we encourage immediately putting something in a will, because unfortunately unexpected things can happen to people while they're in this whole process. And so we bring all of that up. Now, there's only so much you can anticipate the way you'll feel about things once you've gone through the actual process. And so there's only so much you can do to, you know, to try to help people through that process early on. Afterwards, once there are embryos to donate, we also have support from our health psychologists to help have conversations with our donors and our potential recipients to talk about those issues as well. But we certainly do hit it head on.
Now, of course, many people who are going through this process are hoping to have more than one child. And so this is a years-long process for people, even if they have success immediately. It can be a years-long process.
Absolutely.
For people. Is there a shelf life for a frozen embryo? I mean, do they stay in the state that they are, or are they less successful as the years go on?
Oh, it's a great question, and it's an amazing technology. It seems that once embryos are frozen, they're frozen in time. The pregnancy rates are related to the age at which the woman was when the embryos were frozen. So they can come back and see us in 20 years and have the same pregnancy rates that they would have had 20 years ago, and the embryo survives very well. Any problems with the embryo surviving freezing or thawing is usually in the freezing or thawing process, not in the storage process. So assuming all of our systems are in place, there's really no so-called shelf life to the embryos, which is pretty amazing.
And as these embryos are frozen, what is the cost for a couple or an individual to continue keeping that storage going forward?
Compared to the cost that they've been through, it's very little. Honestly, right. It's a few hundred dollars, I believe. Lydia can probably talk more specifically to the exact numbers, but per year of storage, initial fees for the whole IVF procedure cover initial few years of storage to give people some time to make decisions. And then after that, it's a relatively nominal cost for the annual storage. But every year, we send out a letter from the lab to say, you know, your storage fee is due, but here are your options. Just to remind you, these are our options that we offer here. You can use your embryos yourself. You can donate them to research. You can donate them either anonymously or through a known situation, as Lydia has described. You can discard them at any time. You can transfer them outside of our clinic. So those are offered every year when we do ask for the storage fee, just to remind people and to offer our consultation services to talk about those options.
And while those embryos can be stored almost indefinitely, there is some pressure to make a decision, right? Just because of the limitations of storage space.
Right. Absolutely. What we have decided to do, somewhat based on recommendations from our professional society and just sort of the general age of menopause, honestly, is to make that age 50 for the female owner of the embryos, which may or may not be the person who actually donated, who was the provider of the eggs, but that can get complicated. But basically, so for the female owner of the embryos at that point, once they turn 50, that's sort of what we've set out as the limitation. And so a decision has to be made by that point. And it is pretty remarkable. Usually, say they might be 28 when they first freeze the embryos. As when we first talk about that 50-year-old age limit, they laugh and they think, there's no way I would want to parent a child or gestate a child at 50, but as they get into their 40s, it continues to be, well, maybe this would be a possibility. I feel younger, you know. It becomes, so it's very funny to see that difference between the original age and then as women get older and do consider that time limit for what should we do with our embryos. So yes, and part of that is because the hospital just can't, and storage facilities just, you know, feasibly can't store all of the tens of thousands of embryos that are out there.
We're talking this hour about embryo donation or adoption, and you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If this is something that you've had experience with, we'd love to hear your story. If this is something you have questions about doing, we'd love to hear your questions as well. With me this hour, Dr. Ginny Ryan, Assistant Professor of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the University of Iowa Carver School of Medicine, Jeanette Clausen from Lutheran Family Services, Lydia Fine of Iowa City, who is donating her embryos, and Lauren Jarrell, who is the recipient or will be the recipient of those embryos. And Lydia, I know you had something you wanted to add.
Right. And Jeanette was describing the situation and how they approach the adoption process and counseling families. And I wanted to point out that there's a lot of different ways that this can go. For me and Lauren, we decided that we were going to do this. We use the matchmaking service. And from that point forward, it's up to us how we handle it. The two of us are thinking of this not as, she's not an adoptive parent in the way that we're approaching this situation. So we're not thinking of it as an adoption from, you know, from both sides. And I won't have any say in her parenting decisions. I don't want her to feel obligated to please me with her parenting decisions. After these embryos are transferred to her legally, she is their parent. They will be their parents and not us. So you can go lots of different routes when you donate embryos. You could go through an agency like Snowflakes, which is very religion-based. For my husband and I, that wasn't the right route. So we did something different that felt right to us. So I do want to make it clear that there are lots of different options for how you structure your donation and your recipient relationship.
Well, and Ginny, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, there's also a waiting list from couples or individuals who are hoping to receive embryo donations. So that's another route as well.
Correct. So we have an in-house embryo donation program, which, typically the majority of our matchups are completely anonymous. So most of our patients who do decide to donate their embryos do so anonymously. They don't, unlike Lydia, they typically don't want the information about where they're going and what happens with the outcome of the embryo transfer. And so we set those up. We have a bank, basically, of these embryos that have been donated to our anonymous program. And then we have a waiting list. And then and our waiting list right now is about 40 people, individuals or couples. We triage that by if they have any children of their own already at home. And then as our embryos are donated, we come to the people on the list and ask them if this would be a set of embryos that they might be interested in. And then the process involves at that point a little bit of supportive counseling and discussion with health psychology, a review of sexually transmitted disease testing and family history for the donating couple. But other than that, at that point, that's the limits to which we sort of screen our recipient couples. Mm-hmm. So it is different than what Jeanette was describing. Mm-hmm.
So, and when you say you triage based on whether a couple has children already,
yes.
So if they already have a child or children, they would be a lower priority than
the
people
exactly,
who are
exactly.
without.
We have about 10, I believe, right now on the list of people who have no children, and so they're on the upper part of the list.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about embryo donation or adoption this hour. With me, Dr. Ginny Ryan of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Jeanette Clausen of Lutheran Family Services, Lydia Fine of Iowa City, and Lauren Jarrell of St. Paul, Minnesota. We'd love to hear from you as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about embryo donation or embryo adoption. Whenever someone goes through an in vitro fertilization process, there are often embryos that are left over at the end of that process, and couples or individuals have to decide what to do with those frozen embryos. With me this hour, Lydia Fine of Iowa City. She and her husband have decided to donate their remaining embryos in an open arrangement with Lauren Jarrell and her husband. They live in St. Paul, Minnesota, so they're hoping to become parents with the embryos donated by Lydia and her husband. Also with me this hour, Jeanette Clausen is lead caseworker of pregnancy counseling and adoption services at Lutheran Family Services, and Dr. Ginny Ryan is assistant professor of reproductive endocrinology and infertility at the University of Iowa Carver School of Medicine. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. Is this something that you have experience with? We'd love to hear your story. Is this something that you're struggling with right now? Do you have questions about this process or about fertility? You can give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Ryan, the options that people face when they need to decide what to do with their embryos, we covered them briefly before the break, but they can store them and they pay a storage fee for a period of time. They can discard the embryos, which is something that often people will choose to do. They can donate them for medical research, or they can donate those embryos. Now, with the embryos that are in storage, Lydia was talking earlier about, and these are embryos that have a very good chance to be viable embryos and to hopefully make Lauren and Jesse parents. The quality of the embryos varies, though. Can you give me an idea of how we know that and how that works?
Sure. Well, right now, we are only at our program and at increasing number of programs, we only freeze blastocyst embryos, which are embryos that have already grown for 5 to 6 days in our culture dish. And it's really the longest time you can watch embryos before you put them back into the uterus. And so that gives us a lot of information about their chances of working. And it gives us some information. Well, the information we use is based on how we grade them. So we give them a grade and we translate that grade into good, excellent, poor, or fair, basically, here and at many clinics around the country. And so we have criteria for freezing. We'll only freeze an embryo that has gotten to a certain stage of development and that has basically a good quality to it, because we really, those embryos will survive freezing and thawing most often. They have the best chance of that. And they obviously, we want to give people a good chance of conception with those embryos as well. So we know at this point, especially with the day 5 or 6 frozen embryos, that really any individual embryo gives the recipient couple a very good chance of conception. But, you know, it's tricky looking at statistics with people, because you might say they have a 60% chance of conception, but they're never 60% pregnant. They're 0 or 1. So that's a bit tricky. But basically, yes, each individual embryo. And that's nice. And that does allow for what Lydia was describing, which is transferring one of these embryos at a time, which is, what we really encourage. And in fact, we have a policy surrounding that for certain individuals, so that we do just end up with one healthy baby at a time for people.
And the option to donate for medical research, I looked at some of the numbers, and the number that I found was 3 to 5% of individuals choose that route, which is a very small number. Does that reflect your experience?
Yeah, you know, I didn't check in for our exact numbers, but yes, I would say that most of our patients do end up discarding eventually. Those that donate, I believe that more donate to individuals rather than research. What we do when it comes to donating for research is we just have a research pool, a donated pool of embryos that are going to research, and then we come back to the individual donor or the couple who has donated the embryos once we have an actual study that we're going to use the embryos on, and then we ask if that particular study is within their understanding of appropriate for use of their embryos. So we don't have an incredibly active research protocol, so it probably depends a little bit on how much one center might encourage or incentivize or, you know, this kind of donation at all. Mostly our embryos are used in our program to study different indicators of positive outcomes. So we look at proteins or chromosomal components that might suggest that this is what's consistent with a good quality embryo and might end up with a successful pregnancy. So we don't have a lot of ongoing or really any ongoing research looking at other disease processes or things like that. We have no stem cell research going on. And, that's obviously a bit of a controversial topic out there. And that's why I think across the country, some people may not be interested in donating their embryos because of concerns for what might be out in the media and what might happen to those embryos.
So at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, if they're donated for research, they stay at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics?
Yes, yes. Or at the Carver College of Medicine. I mean, internally, yes. Yeah.
And once that donation is made, I mean, it sounds like you go back to the couple or the individual to ask about ongoing research. Are there people who say, we don't want you to come back to us, this is just what we want to happen?
Oh, that's a good question. I suppose probably there are patients who do, but based on our agreement with our institutional review board, that's still a process that we feel like we should go through with individuals. I do think, that especially for individuals who have, just to step back, some individuals donate their embryos. Most individuals donate their embryos after they've had a positive outcome. They have children and they're finished with their family size, like Lydia said, and they move on. Others have had multiple episodes of bad luck. They don't have a child, and yet they have embryos, and they just don't want to be reminded of this part in their lives where they attempted to conceive and were unable to, and they still have embryos left over. And so, even coming back to them to try to help them make decisions about what to do with them is difficult. And so, certainly, if they donate them for research and they don't want to hear anything more about it, that may be that situation, unfortunately.
Well, and there are a lot of terms that get used when talking about these embryos. So I'm very curious about the legal side of this. Jeanette, you used the term baby. We've used the term embryo. You used, Jenny, earlier the term property. The legality of this whole situation is pretty complicated. So, Jenny, I'll let you start. I mean, these embryos obviously are created for the individuals who are going through this process. Who owns them?
Depends on who you ask, I think, really. If you asked, lawyers in a given state, they might have a different response than if you ask us as faculty at the university. We generally do not get outside legal experts involved or counsel involved when we have an anonymous donation. We, they're owned by the person or persons for whom they were originally created, and that may or may not be the genetic parents of those embryos, because again, you could use an egg donor or a sperm donor or both to create those embryos, even though the owners were the people who didn't provide the egg or sperm.
Right, so who wanted the process and were hoping to benefit from
right.
it.
So
or
those
did
people,
benefit from
exactly.
it.
Right. So those people for whom the embryos were made are the owners until they're signed over in a process. But again, we don't usually get legal counsel involved in that if it's an anonymous process. I think it's always a great idea to do so and to have individual legal counsel, as Lydia and Lauren have done, if it's a known situation. It's going to, it's a bit of an investment, but it's going to save potentially a lot of heartache and cost in the future as well. I think you have to go to each individual state to find out if there's any state law where often there will not be about how embryos are considered as far as if it's property law or if it has something to do with custody, similar to child custody. I know there was a case I was just talking to Lydia about in California very recently where they're struggling with the male partner wants them discarded, the female partner does not, and they're trying to bend property law to fit that situation. So it's like so many things in medicine, the technology moves more quickly than the law to respond to it.
Well, and Jeanette, you deal with traditional adoptions and this kind of adoption as well. I mean, legally, what are the differences?
I think Dr. Ryan summed it up beautifully. In Iowa, it is property, and the transfer happens after the legal piece is done. So the legal piece is done, and then, you know, that is when then there's a transfer. So it's very unique as compared to traditional adoption in the process because, of, obviously, with traditional adoption, all the legalities happen after the baby is born. This happens before the property is even
right.
transferred.
And can I ask you a little bit about cost? Because, of course, adoption is an incredibly costly process. In vitro fertilization can be an incredibly costly process if your insurance doesn't cover it. And even if it does, it can be a very costly process. Is this in any way more affordable, Jeanette?
Yeah, it is significantly less than what traditional adoption is because it is not the intensity of work that traditional adoption takes. So what they would pay for with our agency is the home study and education piece, and then one post-placement that is required by Snowflakes that we work with. And then the other fee that they would pay is Snowflakes, and that's the matching and the ongoing retaining of records and follow-up that they are charging for there, and again, significantly less than what a traditional adoption is. The variable would be whatever their insurance covers.
Right, right. Well, and Lauren, let me ask you a little bit about that. I know these are very personal questions, but mm-hmm. I mean, there are obviously you're going to be going through different processes at a hospital that is not close to your home, probably not in your provider network, that kind of thing. I mean, what are the costs for you?
It is significant for us. I mean, you know, it's our insurance is not covering this. So right now, where we're at is it's looking to be about $11,000 to $12,000 total, and that includes our placement fees that we paid, blessed with infertility, any of the medical workup that we have to do, and including the transfer of one of the embryos. So it is, I mean, I think $12,000, anyone can agree, is a significant amount of money. And that's been pretty much our biggest hurdle, you know, throughout this whole thing has been the financial thing. And I think anybody going through infertility that doesn't have insurance coverage, which is relatively common, it's not a commonly covered thing. That's usually their biggest hurdle is the financial, is affording this whole process.
Right, so, certainly. And especially yeah. when people go through multiple procedures and try many different routes, I am sure that
exactly.
the cost can really mount. And Lydia, Lauren mentioned earlier, she has a lawyer, you have a lawyer, you have to go through this legal process. Are there some surprising things that have come up for you in the process that you thought, well, huh, I didn't think of that?
It's been kind of shocking, all of the different eventualities we had to write into our legal contract. And the things you would expect are in there, like how often we would require Lauren and Jesse to notify us. So we said one picture and one letter per year on the status of any resulting children. But also all of these weird things about what could potentially happen to the embryos if certain things happen. So if either Jesse or Lauren were to pass away, one or both were to become gravely disabled, if they were to divorce. So all of these things had to be written into the contract. And so it required some thinking on my husband's part and mine to kind of decide what we wanted to happen in these situations.
Well, and we've talked, of course, a lot about the mothers in this process, the women who carry these babies. But, of course, the fathers are also involved. I mean, Jeanette, maybe you can give us a little bit of insight into that. Do men in this process have as many rights as the women in this process?
I would say yes. I mean, equally so, the way at least we've tried to set it up. When it comes to our embryos, once they're made and in our freezer, whether they have there's been any decision made about them or not, they're actually owned officially by the hospital, interestingly. And so we, again, try to describe that right off the bat. And the reason for that, again, is that the hospital does not want to end up with these tens of thousands of embryos. So they want to have the ability to discard if some of these things don't happen. Storage fees aren't paid. There's a divorce and nothing in a divorce agreement. There's a death and there's nothing in a will. They want to be able to discard these embryos. So we describe to people right from the get-go that the hospital owns these embryos, but they're for your mutual use, and you both have to agree on what to do with these embryos. And again,
and you encourage people to agree in advance.
Exactly, exactly. We strongly encourage the will immediately, but a lot of people, as with any development of a will for any reason, don't do that. And so we actually have written up a form that we have people use as well. We don't know how well that will stand up in court, but it's better than nothing. It's better than just a verbal description of what people might do. And so we have, you know, co-signatures from both members of the couple, if, again, there are two members of a couple, and if they are male and female. But we try to have, you know, both partners equally understand that even though they might not have both had their bodies participate equally in the whole process, that when it comes to the embryos that are resulting, that they should have feel equal rights to them.
We're nearly out of time, but Lydia and Lauren, I would love just in the final moment to get your advice for people who might be considering this or have embryos that they have to make decisions about. Lydia?
Gosh, I think for me, it was just a lot of soul searching. I took some time to think about, as I said earlier, what decision could I live with for the rest of my life? And a lot of moms tell me that they could never do what we're doing. And I tell them, you know, I think if you found yourself in these shoes, you could do it because it feels right. And I think a lot of moms especially will recognize that children are an amazing gift. And if they can give them to someone else, that they should.
And Lauren, how about advice from you? I know you're not done with this process yet, but what would you tell someone in your shoes?
You know, I think with anything, when someone's being faced with an option like receiving embryos or adopting embryos, they might feel like they're at the end of their line as to what they can either afford or what they can physically do. And I just want to give hope to everybody. I have a little sign in my window that I made, and it says hope. And that's been, like, my biggest thing, is that there are such beautiful, wonderful options out there. You know, maybe not everyone is open to taking and receiving embryos that aren't genetically part of them. But if you are, I can just tell you that it's a beautiful thing, especially, you know, whether it's anonymous or an open relationship. We've just been so blessed this past year with this process and meeting Lydia and Nathan. And my hope for anyone else in this position is that they too can find themselves in a similar situation and have this beautiful gift.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, and best of luck. I hope this works.
Thank you.
Lauren Jarrell and her husband live in St. Paul, Minnesota. They are the recipients of the embryos donated by Lydia Fine and her husband. Lydia, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Dr. Jenny Ryan, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Dr. Jenny Ryan's an assistant professor of reproductive endocrinology and infertility at the University of Iowa Carver School of Medicine. And Jeanette Clausen, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jeanette Clausen is lead caseworker of pregnancy counseling and adoption services at Lutheran Family Services. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.